Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Tana French. She's a Dubliner. She's out with her new novel, The Witch Elm, available everywhere from the good folks at Viking Books. It's her first standalone novel, which is a departure from her Dublin Murder Squad series that we've had her on to talk about before. In this book, we meet Toby Hennessy. He's a happy-go-lucky guy, and his life changes forever when he surprises a couple burglars who beat him senseless and essentially leave him for dead. Since he's got this brain injury, Toby and his girlfriend Melissa move into the Ivy House with Toby's uncle, and it's Toby's ancestral home. There's a skull discovered in the trunk of a witch elm tree. That's kind of a tip-off as to the title of the book. And in the backyard, and then the rest of the skeleton is found in the tree hollow. The home is filled with all kinds of happy memories for Toby, but now it's a crime scene, and Toby starts to uncover some family secrets and lies. Tana, I did not want to give away much of the plot, but before we jump into the actual book, this idea of writing a standalone out of the way from the Dublin Murder Squad, writing from the perspective of a crime victim, what did that do as far as the way you wrote the book from your perspective as the writer?
Well, it's a very different way of looking at a criminal investigation, because I was used to looking at it from the perspective of the detective. And for the detective, all the procedural stuff is kind of, it's a source of strength. It's something that they know very well, they're at home with, they're the ones driving it and controlling it. It helps them put things back in order. But from the other side, from Toby's perspective, from all the different other perspectives that you get in an investigation, like witnesses, suspects, perpetrators, victims, all of that has to look very different. It's got to be something that's alien and incomprehensible and often terrifying. It's not a source of control. It's something that strips away control. And I like the idea of giving a voice to those other perspectives as well, but it's a very different way of looking at absolutely everything procedural that happens.
Before the night when Toby was attacked, he reminded me of the Jerry Seinfeld character on the episode where Kramer gives him the nickname Even Steven, because everything always seemed to work out for him. He would lose a stand-up gig, but then another club would book him 2 minutes later. Was Toby before that night, in fact, an Even Steven?
I think that's kind of a very good way of putting it. He is, in fact, the guy who always has come out on the right side of every coin flip all his life. I mean, he starts out with all the easiest difficulty settings. He's white, he's male, he's straight, he's from a well-off family, a stable family, he's loved, he's good-looking, he's charming, he's intelligent, he's got it all going for him. And in some ways that makes it almost harder for him when for the first time he does not come out on the right side of the coin flip and he suddenly feels vulnerable. It shifts his whole position within the world, it shifts the way he sees reality, and it changes his sense of himself. His sense of himself has been very badly battered, and he's got to start again in what seems to him like a completely new world.
Well, the first part of the book does deal with the fallout from the beating, and what did you do to create this realistic portrayal of someone who's been through such rough physical trauma to capture the realism of both the emotional and physical aspects of it?
Yeah, you're right, it is the emotional and the physical stuff, because he's got a traumatic brain injury, and he is, in fact, ironically lucky in that, because the lasting effects are relatively mild in him, but he does have a certain amount of aphasia. He stumbles over his sentences, his memory is fairly messed up, he's got a limp, his eyelid droops, but almost harder to capture than that was he's got PTSD as well, and that affects the way he responds to everything. The world doesn't feel like this friendly, benign place anymore. So I had to do a lot of research on both of those, both on traumatic brain injury and on PTSD, and on the various ways in which they can manifest, because for both of those things, there's a really wide range of responses and of effects. I wanted to get it right, because when you're dealing with something like that, that it's so serious and can be so devastating to people's lives, you don't want to take it lightly. You want to give it the research it deserves. So I spent a lot of time on that.
Well, then there's also the aspect of Toby wasn't born with any of these physical ailments, and I liken it to somebody that was maybe born blind or born deaf. They don't know any different, but Toby's had his mind his whole life, and now he doesn't. So doesn't that add something into just influencing his basically being upset with the state he's in now?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. He feels like he's been taken away from himself, the person he's always been, who was, again, he was lucky. He was always physically and mentally healthy. And he took that for granted as a natural state of affairs. And all of a sudden, both of those things are gone. And he feels robbed and violated, and it's a very frightening situation, because the thing he's fighting against, as he says in the book, it's not something he can outwit or outrun. He can't fix it. He can't get away from it. The enemy is himself, his new self, whatever that is.
Well, obviously the tree is a character, which we know from the title. The Ivy House ends up being a character in and of itself. And as a writer, how do you take a setting, maybe a tree or a house, and make it so alive to become a character? What's that process?
See, I love places. I love settings. I've always had a thing about them. And I love the sense that they are so deeply charged, especially places that are the center of a lot of deeply emotional experiences and memories for people, are so charged with all of those memories that they take on a life of their own. So for me, it's about Toby and the experiences he's had around these places, the good memories he's got with his cousins, of, you know, their childhood in the garden and running wild all through the house and teenage parties. And for him, though, that's one of the things that comes under siege as he starts to find out gradually that his two closest cousins, their experience and their memories and the charge around the Ivy House for them is nothing like what it is for him. And so he starts to question, he's already in a place where he's questioning who he is, and now he's having to question whether his past is what he always believed it was.
Talking with Tana French, the book is The Witch Elm. It's available now wherever your books are sold. Tana, the idea about the skeleton in The Witch Elm, other than, it was a little bit inspired by a true story, right? That particular detail. That particular detail, not the rest of the book.
No, just that particular detail, and I went quite a distance away from it. But when I was starting to bounce around ideas for a new book, my brother sent me this link to the story of Bella in the Witch Elm, who was a woman whose skeleton was found in a tree, found by kids, down the trunk of a witch elm in England in 1943. And to this day, nobody knows who she was, how she got there, but graffiti started to appear around there, and have sporadically ever since, saying, who put Bella down the witch elm? Nobody knows who's leaving the graffiti, why they're calling her Bella. And my brother sent me this with a note that said, well, this sounds like a Tana French book. For some reason, that clicked together with the other stuff I was bouncing around in my head. And while, obviously, this is nothing like the story of Bella in the witch elm, that was definitely the spark that set it going.
You mentioned Toby's cousins earlier, and there's a scene in the book where they're playing a game of basically midnight confession, and this type of conversation can be very humorous or it can be very tragic, but can you always trust those stories from long ago since they're being told with so many decades of living since their supposed occurrences?
Exactly. That's exactly what I was aiming for. You can't trust them on an objective level. No, never, because not only are they being told in hindsight with the benefit of a whole lot of other experiences laid over them, and each character's own needs, what the character wants to see themselves as, how they want to see that action. But they're also being told with an agenda, clearly, because when people come out with their midnight confession, there's a reason why they're doing it. They want to project a certain image of themselves, or they want to make a certain statement, or they want to have a certain effect on the listeners. So even the deepest confession in this context is not necessarily reliable.
And I've read a lot of novels over the years with an unreliable narrator because of alcoholism or drugs or PTSD or whatever. But with the unreliable characters in this book, and that's really what we have here, you can't trust anything they're saying. How does that affect you as the writer? Do you even trust them as you're writing their characters?
Not really. That was something I wanted a lot from this book. Because, again, Toby's living in a new world where everything is unreliable and nothing is what he always thought it was. So it was kind of important that the characters had that same quality of being slippery and kind of quicksandy. They're not stable underfoot. They're not something that he can put his weight on. So I wanted that to be coming at him from every direction. And it is weird as a writer, because you do find yourself, writing a scene and then going, oh, hang on a second, she said that in this scene. Would it be more interesting and more in character if she was actually lying? And then going back and reworking everything in the light of possible lies after lies.
It seems like every detail in this book has a specific purpose, and including something that seems as minute as Toby's Uncle Hugo being a genealogist. But is this attention to detail a result of editing where you take out extraneous materials, or is this something you cognizantly do as you write?
book, it's long enough, but I figure there's got to be a certain amount of extraneous, but you should see what we took out. It's not something you, I think, consciously do as you write, but subconsciously, if you're thinking enough about the book and the character and the themes and what the character needs to see and needs to encounter in the course of this story, I think what you come up with is inevitably going to have a certain level of relevance. Now, mind you, I do tend to throw in everything in the kitchen sink on first draft, and then my editor comes in and tells me, okay, this is, I'm very gently, I'm sure this was fun to write, but I'm not sure the readers really need to read it. So I do the cutting then. But I think if you're focused enough around the heart of the book, then at least we'll hope the majority of the stuff you put in tends to be relevant to that core stuff.
As a writer, do you keep your first drafts of the books just for posterity?
Not for posterity, but just kind of for fun, yeah. I write longhand and then sort of bits of scenes longhand and then on the computer I sort of expand and amplify and finish the scene. And yeah, I do. I have all the bits. And I think it would be fun to go back somewhere along the way and look at it and go, oh my God, I was not considering doing that.
Well, I've seen readers at book readings, and they'll ask the author, well, you know, what did you cut out of the book? And, you know, somehow I think that just sort of cheapens the deal because the book is what it is. But do you get that from readers that they want to know, well, was there something that cut, a different plot point that was cut out?
That's not what I get. I get more often people asking me for answers to the questions. They feel like there might be a bit more answer in there somewhere along the way.
All right. Well, the book is fantastic. It kept me entertained for, oh, the better part of 6 hours as I sat and read this in one sitting. The book is The Witch Elm by Tana French. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Viking. Go out and check it out. And if you haven't read her Dublin Murder series, go ahead and check that out as well. That's a Dublin Murder Squad series, rather. Go out and check that out as well. That's a fantastic series. Tana, excellent book. Thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Thanks so much, Brian, and thanks for having me on.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.